The second exercise that I wanted to propose to you is the one that has been given on the last session held on May 19th, 2020, of course, into which we analyzed a pulmonary ventilator. Let's read together the text of the exam. Respiratory failure is one of the most common complications related to COVID-19. The infection triggered by the new coronavirus that emerged in China. As many as 10% of affected patients need intensive care treatment, basically to be treated with a mechanical ventilation or artificial ventilation and support their breathing. These life-saving procedures take place through a medical device that is present in each intensive care unit, the so-called pulmonary ventilator. The pulmonary ventilator is a medical device that aims at integrating or replacing the activity of the muscles related to breathing. It has the diaphragm and the intercostal ones. Simply, the mechanical ventilator is a device designed to blow air or gas mixtures into the patient's lungs with a specific frequency and with finely calibrated pressures. Stop insufflation and allow gas exchange between the alveoli and blood capillaries. Promote exhalation with the release of gas, carbon dioxide, which occurs due to the elastic nature of the lungs. Start a new cycle that allows you to replicate in all respects the natural lung respiration. So a very complete, let's say, not simulator, but support that replaces a not properly working lung. Modern lung ventilators automatically calculate the volume of air to be conveyed to the patient based on the recorded pressures. The air is blown into the rib cage through an instrumentation that is typical of the so-called intubation procedure. The main one is the endotracheal tube inserted into the patient's mouth and which, as its name suggests, passes through the trachea. In practice, trace the path to direct the air directly into the lungs. Intubation is always practiced after having put the patient to sleep, so he doesn't notice the insertion and removal of the tube, considered an invasive procedure. The passage from the forced inspiratory phase to the expiratory one is obtained through the opening and closing of suitable valves, as shown in the figure. In the bottom of the page figure, the mixed air is blown into the lungs through a bellows pump, look at the figure, moved by an electromagnetic actuator, and by monitoring the patient's electrocardiograph, the frequency of the actuator is automatically adjusted based on the heart rate acquired. The questions, the requirements. Draw the block scheme of the acquisition regulation chain, identifying the input and output variables in every block, and in particular the process variables. Calculate the transfer function of the process, highlighting what variables must be known. Plot the Bode diagram of the loop function, process plus actuator, discussing the eventual problems in terms of stability and instability. Show the numerical implementation of the regulator if it is necessary. Design the circuit that drives the actuator pumping the air into the patient's lung. And finally, the short answer questions. How many bits are needed to the microprocessor to measure the process variable with a 2% accuracy and to drive the actuator and to regulate the opening and closing of the valves? What benefits are given by the cascade control? What hypothesis must be done? Write an analytical, that stands for mathematical expression, eventually approximated, of the induced electromotive force in the second stator of the induction generator. And finally, why the UJT current augments after overcoming the threshold, even with the voltage applied to the emitter pin lower than the threshold itself. Looking at the solution of this problem, the first thing that we have to set is, as usual, the entity that corresponds to the process variable. The text helps in this case because explicitly says that the regulation of the force with which the air is inflated into the lungs of the patient is the monitoring of the electrocardiograph frequency. In other words, we establish, the machine establishes the rate with which the heart beats and automatically sets the rate, the frequency with which the air is pumped in the patient itself. Since the problem explicitly says that an electromagnetic actuator is employed, the control variable is the current, and the manipulated variable is the force exerted by the actuator, so as the air is injected into the patient's lungs. But we have to understand what is the relationship between this force and the rate of the ECG. In other words, if other manipulated variables exist or no. We know that pump, whatever is its architecture, can exit in pressure, let's say, or in flow rate. That is, we can control the pressure with which the fluid exits from the pump, or the flux, the velocity, with which the same fluid can be sent to a recipient, a basin, or in this case, a human organ. In the specific problem that we are considering, we can ask to ourselves what is the most convenient output that can be considered, that is pressure or flux. Finally, we can decide to monitor, to control the flow rate, since we want to monitor continuously the ECG frequency, that is clearly related to the frequency with which the pump is managed, and the frequency is the inverse of a time, and the velocity with which the fluid exits from the pump or with which the actuator is activated features the inverse of a time. Therefore, frequency, velocity, flow rate basically are magnitudes that are very close, very related one with the other. On the contrary, the pressure is basically a force, and a force involves an acceleration. So, as a first approximation, let's consider that the pump will exit with a controlled flow rate, and this is the second manipulated variable that we will include in our shortlist. Now let's characterize the single part of the actuator and of the process. For what concerns the electromagnetic device, the force is proportional to the current supplied, and this is well known from the course. But concerning the pump, we must observe that the force F developed by the pump itself is split in a part that is able to push, to inflate the air to the destination, plus, if we want to be very precise, another part that is necessary to win the elastic opposition of such a kind of device that is working like a bellow. Therefore, the force is expressed as constant time the second derivative of the linear displacement x plus another constant k prime time the displacement x corresponding to the elastic opposition. For what concerns the flow rate, we well know that it is given by the product of the velocity with which the fluid crosses the pump time the section. Therefore, can be written as A, the surface, the section, I mean, time the derivative function of the displacement x. And finally, we can suppose, in a first approximation, that the ECG rate is proportional to the flow rate of the fluid itself. Therefore, assembling, let's say, all these considerations together, we can conclude that the gain of the control loop given by the ratio between process variable and control variable can be expressed by the ratio between ECG rate and flow rate, time the ratio between the flow rate and the displacement, time the displacement divided by the force, time the force divided by the current. When we say displacement, we mean basically the amount of the movement made internally the pump by the actuator. The transfer function that exits from all the partial contribution of these components, these ratios, is characterized by a zero in the origin divided by expression S square K plus K prime that provides a point into which a frequency into which the gain becomes infinite. That is, we have a resonance. And clearly, the shape of this function in the Laplace domain of the frequency, or in the Bode diagram as shown in the solution, features only a limited area, a limited range of frequencies into which eventually the process can work. That is, well beyond the resonance point and before the point into which the diagram crosses the zero axis. On the contrary, when the slope is positive, that is before the resonance and in the resonance, there is no possibility for such a kind of activity because we know that the rules of the automatic control prevent us from working the system. In other words, is not stable. This is the situation concerning the model that we have taken into the account. But if we neglect the elasticity property relative to the bellow, Basically, we must exclude the component k prime time x in the expression of the force exerted by the actuator inside the pump. This will make to disappear the term k prime in the denominator of the gain expression, and basically we will have only a pole into the origin that makes the system clearly stable without any need of complicated controller function if we don't want to extend the bandwidth, perhaps adding a zero pole compensation. But the management of the control is not finished here, because we should ask to ourselves if some delays exist, and the answer is positive. Many sources of delays are present in such a kind of process, and the text explicitly describes them. First, the text says that the control must open the inspiratory valve and close the expiratory one to inflate the air into the patient's lung. Then it is necessary to wait for a while just to favor the exchange of the air internally to the lung itself, therefore between the alveoli and the blood capillaries we can have oxygenation, so as the quality of the blood of the patient is the same as the inspiration would be spontaneous. Third, open the expiratory valve and close the inspiratory one, just as to allow the expiration phase, the output, let's say, of the air exchange with the alveoli, and full of carbon dioxide. And finally, the text says that the ECG of the patient is properly monitored, and of course the information will be transmitted to the microprocessor. So we can imagine four possible sources for delays. Some of them may be longer, some of them may be shorter. Perhaps we can conclude that the transmission of the ECG frequency rate is negligible in terms of communication times, but the pause to favor the exchange of the air in the alveoli, and the time necessary to switch on one valve and the other one, or vice versa, during the expiratory phase, probably must be taken into account. In any case, we are talking in terms of orders of magnitude of milliseconds, and we are completely able to compensate for such a kind of delays by means of three or four blocks that implement suitable speed predictions. A more detailed comment is necessary to describe the circuit that will activate the electromagnetic actuator, because in this case the movement that must be exerted inside the pump is bidirectional. Therefore, we are considering device that can be supplied, of course, with a silicon controlled rectifier, but in this case its movement would be only bidirectional, monodirectional. In other words, we have to replace the SCR in the circuit that we have seen at lesson with a triac, but the logic that is devoted to the management of such a kind of different switch must be slightly modified. Looking at the circuit that is drawn in the solution, we see that the architecture is basically the same as if we would have a silicon controlled rectifier. The problem is related to the fact that the triac must be switched on both in the positive and in the negative wave of the alternate power supply signal. And the previous solution featured only the charge of the capacitor that triggers the UJT in the positive wave, accordingly to the activity of the silicon controlled rectifier. Now we must conceive both the possibilities, switch in the positive and in the negative, but after having switched the triac, we have immediately to avoid that in the same wave another signal, another activation arrives to the gate of the triac. That is, we must avoid that the capacitor charge again so as to activate the UJT, and by means of the current of the UJT we set the activation signal onto the gate of the triac. If you remember how this circuit works, the possibility of keeping the capacitor discharged is related to the MOS N channel below the P1 and connected to the zero crossing circuit. Compared to the previous solution, here we apply the modification that allows to properly manage the situation. You see, in fact, that we have applied a XOR gate between the gate of the MOS device and the output of the operational amplifier. In fact, when we have that the two input signals of the operational amplifier are different, depending on the fact that is prevalent the negative input or the positive input, we will have in output of the operational amplifier a logic 0 or a logic 1. Let's consider what happens in the positive wave. In this case, the negative input is greater than the positive input, therefore the logic output is 0, and we must keep interdicted the n-channel MOS. Therefore the gate must be kept to 0, and another signal that is managed by the microprocessor will enter into the XOR gate, for example another logic 0, so as the output of the XOR is 0 and the n-channel MOS is not active. Therefore the current through the PMOS will charge the capacitor and will activate the UJT and therefore the triac device. But immediately after this, the microprocessor has to switch the common signal to 1, so as the output of the XOR becomes 1 and the N-channel MOS will start to be active, therefore absorbing all the current that arrives from the P-channel MOS and preventing the capacitor from charging again. Clearly the microprocessor is able to do this because the interval of time from the zero crossing point of the waveform up to the moment into which the triac is activated is predetermined a priori by the microprocessor. Therefore a simple timer can allow the microprocessor to know when this time has expired, so as to apply the suitable signal to the XOR port, to the XOR gate, I mean. Conversely, in the negative waveform, the negative input of the amplifier is lower than the positive one, so we have a 1 logic, I mean, in output from the operational amplifier. Again, we have to keep the MOS not active, therefore the command in this case will be 1, and 1 + 1 gives 0. Therefore, all the current coming from the PMOS channel will charge the capacitor, and once more, when reached the suitable threshold of the UJT, the TRIAC will be switched on. Immediately after, the microprocessor need to activate the NMOS channel so as to prevent another activation of the TRIAC, and this will be done by switching the command signal from 1 to 0, so as the XOR gate will provide a logic 1 in output that will activate the NMOS channel, and therefore all the current coming from the P-channel MOS will go to the ground through this one. This is the modification, very simple, that allows to introduce the TRIAC into that circuit without modifying excessively the older architecture, and allowing us to manage the actuator in a bidirectional way. We could also conceive another modification that is related to the emulator of the silicon controlled rectifier that could be considered, because the load in this case is still an actuator whose electronic nature is inductive, but since basically it is made by a wire wounded as a solenoidal circuit, it could be considered also a big resistor, and therefore that kind of solution could be considered okay. I invite you to think how to use that kind of circuit in this case, considering the fact that instead of a silicon control rectifier, the emulated answer that must be provided in that case is the one of a TRIAC, that is, it works both in the positive and in the negative wave of the alternate signal. And now let's come to the questions that the XAM asks. The first one is related, let's say, to some design issues of such a kind of problem, because we are requested to estimate the number of the bits that the microprocessor loses due to the conversion with a suitable precision that will bring us to calculate the logarithm on base 2 of 100 divided by 2, and therefore to have 6 bits devoted to this kind of conversion. But the problem requires also to estimate the bits that are needed to manage the actuator, and moreover to properly control the valves. Considering the actuator, we have to take into account that the circuit that will control it, that will drive it, is the previous one. And in that circuit, we have introduced a DAC, a digital to analog converter, therefore with the same precision as the one requested in the opposite conversion analog to digital. Therefore, we can imagine that even in this case, we are devoting 6 bits plus the start of conversion and end of conversion to the management of the DAC from the microprocessor, together with the command signal. So we have 9 bits devoted to the management of the actuator. And what about the valves? If the valves are on-off, that is, all open or all closed, basically we need only a switch to perform the right operation, and we can imagine that one bit will be devoted to the expiratory valve and one to the inspiration one. But if the regulation is more precise, that is, if the valves are gate-regulated valves, we must control a motor that will move the gate so as to regulate the span of the valve, and through this the amount of the flow rate of the fluid that crosses the valve. In this case, the previous considerations related to how to regulate a motor with a circuit, with an SSCR or a TRIAC device, are valid, and the number of the bits devoted to such a kind of task, of course, will augment. Concerning the second question, you can refer to the block of the slides named actuators, and in particular to the slides 15, 16 and 17. This describes very well the cascade control, and in particular the hypothesis under which such a solution is able to work. First of all, the knowledge a priori of more informations that can relate the present set point to another set point that can be managed through another transducer. So we have a certain level of redundancy in this control, the knowledge, the transducer, and another block for the control. Moreover, you remember, we have to ask to ourselves if the process works at the null frequency or not, because this allows, in some cases, to avoid the pole in the origin, therefore to eliminate every pole in the internal chain regulated through the cascade control. Concerning the third question, we must remember that the induction-based generator consists of two stator circuits and one rotor. In the one, we isolated and identified two coils, symmetric coils, that were irradiated by the magnetic field generated by the first stator. These two coils were characterized by electromotive forces that in turn generated magnetic fields. Considering the composition of the two fields for every couple of coils, we analyzed the influence of this resulting magnetic field with respect to the second stator. And we observed that when this component is perfectly aligned, horizontally aligned with the second stator, we will have the maximum coupling, so as to have the maximum voltage considered into the second stator and detectable by the microprocessor, while on the contrary, when the composition of the magnetic fields is vertical with respect to that direction, the coupling of the resulting magnetic field with the second stator is in practice null. This concept suggests that the coupling between the magnetic fields present in every couple of coils that we can identify with respect to the second stator follows a law that is ruled by the cosine function, and the cosine of the angular velocity that characterizes the rotor. The amplitude of the electromotive force induced in the horizontal stator instead will be related to the magnetic field that induces the electromotive force in every coil of the rotor. Therefore, we should approximate such an expression with an appearance constant term that instead contains the influence of all the components of all the coils in this term. Finally, we have made the characterization of this situation for a couple of coils, but since the inductor could be split in many couple of coils, of course everyone will influence and will couple the second stator with each its own magnetic field. Therefore, the electromotive force in the second stator will be the resulting sum of all the components given by all the coils that we can identify and we can obtain splitting the induction-based generator in several parts. To write an analytical expression, we could say that the electromotive force is the sum with an index that spans all the symmetric couples that can be identified into the induction-based generator of the terms V0 is an amplitude of that particular coil, cosine of the angular velocity omega time t. And finally, let's consider the last question that asks why the UJT current can augment after the threshold is overcame that allows to activate the UJT itself. The reason is shown in the diagram that relates the voltage at the emitter point of the UJT transistor with the current that crosses the PN junction, and therefore the device itself, the UJT itself. Clearly, the shape of this relationship of this curve is similar to a nose. That is, the current increases, augments slightly up to the voltage applied to the emitter, reaches the threshold that I remember is 2/3, the voltage applied to the two bases between anode and cathode, I mean, plus 0.7. And when this voltage is reached, the current is amazingly greater, and is greater even if the voltage at the emitter point diminishes. Why this? Because the activation of the UJT means that the voltage applied at the emitter point polarizes the PN junction. And since the P part is very rich, full of positive charges, they will cross the border between P and N, and in an avalanche fashion, they will invade the lower part of the UJT. This provides a very big current, but causes an accumulation of positive charges in that area close to the cathode of the UJT. And this means that the difference of potential between the emitter and that area diminishes. Therefore, the positive charge are required to have less energy to cross the border, and the current increases as well. In other words, we could say that the resistivity between the emitting point and the base B2 is lower, and it is easier for the positive charge to go from one point to the other one. Of course, it is necessary that the voltage at the emitter point is provided in a continuous way. Otherwise, like in the case of the circuit that we have seen, the capacitor, that is the source of voltage provided to the emitting point, is emptied, and therefore the current is very intense but short, since when the capacitor has been emptied, no more charges are available to cause that phenomenon.